All she did was clench her jaw. She noticed a man coming her way, dressed in a blue suit and with slicked back, dark blonde hair. He sat down next to her and looked with exaggerated concern at her split lip and bruised face. "My God, who did you manage to upset?" He would have received a withering look at the least, but at that moment her mobile buzzed. It was an encrypted message from Blomqvist, which set her even more on edge. She got up, tossed some 100-kroner notes onto the bar, and gave the man a shove on her way out. The city was shimmering, and music was playing in the distance. It was a glorious summer evening for anyone in the mood for it. Salander noticed none of that. She looked ready to kill. She searched on her mobile for the name she had been given and soon realized that Rachel Greitz had protected identity status. That in itself was not a problem. We all leave traces, for example when we buy things online and are careless about giving out our addresses. But as she crossed Strömbron on her way to Gamlastan, she was unable to do anything, not even hack a site where Rachel Greitz might have bought a book. Instead, she thought about dragons. She thought about how, as a little girl, she had run shoeless through Stockholm until she got to the royal palace and hurried past a tall pillar towards a cathedral which was lit up in the darkness. That was Storkirken. She knew nothing about it then. She was simply drawn to it. She was freezing cold. Her socks were soaked through, and she needed to get some rest and warmth. She ran into an inner courtyard and walked through the side doors of the cathedral. The ceiling was so high that it seemed to reach to the sky. She remembered how she had gone further in, so that people would stop staring at her. And that's when she saw the statue. Only later did she realize that it was famous, said to represent St. George, killing a dragon and rescuing a damsel in distress, but that was not something Salander knew then or would even have cared about. She saw something entirely different in the statue that evening. An assault. The dragon, she still remembered it clearly, was on its back, with a spear through its body, while a man with an indifferent, blank expression struck the animal with his sword. The dragon was defenceless and alone, and that had made Salander think of her mother. With every muscle in her body she felt that she wanted to save her. Or better still, she wanted to be the dragon herself, and fight back, and breathe fire, and pull the rider down from his horse and kill him, because the knight was clearly none other than Zala, her father. He was the evil destroying their lives. But that was not all. There was another figure depicted in the statue, a woman one could easily miss because she was standing to one side. She wore a crown on her head and was holding out her hands as if reading a book. The strangest thing was that she was so calm, as if she was looking out over a meadow or an ocean, rather than a slaughter. At the time, Salander could not recognize the woman as the maiden being rescued. In her eyes the woman was ice-cold and indifferent. She looked exactly like the woman with birthmark from whom she had just escaped, and who, like all the others, was allowing the violence and the abuse to continue at her home. That was how she saw it. Not only were her mother and the dragon being tormented, but the world was looking on heartlessly. Salander felt a deep revulsion for the knight and the woman in the statue, and she had run back out into the rain and the storm, shaking with cold and fury. It was all so long ago, and yet remarkably present. Now, many years later, she crossed the bridge to Gamlastan on her way home. She muttered the name to herself, Rachel Greitz. This was her link to the registry. She had been looking for it ever since Palmgren came to visit her at Floedberry. Hilda opened a beer. By now her left eye was wandering a little. At times she lost her train of thought and seemed gripped by remorse. At others she was astonishingly focused, as if the alcohol had merely sharpened her wits.
"I don't know what Lisbeth did after she ran out of Storkirken, only that she managed to beg some money at Central Station the next day and pinched a pair of oversized shoes and a down jacket at Orlens. Agneta was beside herself with worry, of course, and I was furious and told Rachel that she would jeopardize the whole project if she went through with her plan. In the end, she gave in. She left Lisbeth alone. But she never stopped hating her. I think she was involved when Lisbeth was locked up at St. Stefan's."
"Why do you say that?"
"Because her good friend Peter Teleborian worked at the clinic."
"They were friends?"
"Rachel was Teleborian's psychoanalyst. They shared a belief in repressed memory and other similarly ridiculous theories, and he was very loyal to her. But the interesting thing is that Raquel not only hated Lisbeth, she also became more and more frightened of her. I believe she recognized, long before anyone else did, just what Lisbeth was capable of.
Do you think Raquel had anything to do with Holger Palmgren's death?
Hilda glanced down at her shoes. Voices could be heard outside on the quay.
She's merciless. I can vouch for that more than anyone. The rumour mill she set in motion when I decided to leave the registry just about did me in. But murder? I'm not sure. I would find that hard to believe. At least I'd rather not believe it. Still less.
Hilda pulled a face. Blomqvist waited for her to continue.
Still less can I believe it about Daniel Brolin. He's such a vulnerable, gifted boy. He would never harm anyone, least of all his twin brother. They were made to be together.
Blomqvist was about to answer that this is exactly what people say when their friends or acquaintances commit the most heinous crimes. We just don't understand. It's not possible. Not him, not her, surely. And yet it happens. We have the highest opinion of someone, and then that person is blinded by rage, and the unthinkable happens. But he said nothing and tried not to jump to conclusions. There were any number of possible scenarios. They talked for a while longer and then ran through a few practical details, including how they would communicate over the coming days. He urged her to take every care and to look after herself. Then he checked his mobile to see if there was a late train back to Stockholm. He had 15 minutes. He packed away his voice recorder, gave her a hug, and rushed off. On his way to the station, he tried once more to reach Salander. He both needed and wanted to see her. It had been too long. On the train he watched a shaky video his sister had sent him, in which a furious Bashir Kazi appeared to confess to being behind the murder of Jamal Chowdhury. Not only had the video gone viral, it had also triggered a flurry of activity in police headquarters on Bergsgatan. This was intensified when, soon after, two sophisticated hand movement analyses were sent to Bublansky of the murder squad. Those analyses were also the reason a young man with a runner's physique and a lost look in his eyes was slumped in one of the interview rooms on the 7th floor, together with his imam, Hassan Ferdusi. Bublansky had known Ferdusi reasonably well for some time now. Ferdusi and Bublansky's fiancée, Farah Sharif, had been students together. He was also one of those leaders who worked to encourage closer interaction between the various religious communities in the face of the country's rising anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. Bublansky did not always see eye to eye with Ferdusi, especially over the question of Israel, but he had great respect for him, and he had greeted the imam with a reverential bow. He heard that Ferdusi had helped to bring about a breakthrough in the investigation into Jamal Chowdhury's death, and he was grateful but also dejected. It revealed the extent of his colleague's incompetence, and Bublansky was overloaded with work as it was. Fru Torell had at last gotten in touch to say that someone had indeed come to see her in connection with the papers she had handed over to Holger Palmgren. A certain Professor Martin Steinberg, a respected citizen, apparently, who had worked for both the social services and the government. Steinberg told her that some individuals had already gotten themselves into difficulties because of those papers, and made her swear before God and the late Professor Caldeen that she would never again talk about them. Nor should she mention Steinberg's visit, for the safety and well-being of our former patients. Steinberg then took away her backup, a USB stick. Torill did not remember what had been on it other than the medical notes on Salander. But Bublansky was uneasy, especially since he had not been able to get in touch with Steinberg. Bublansky wanted to spend more time trying to unravel the mystery, but he would have to forget about it all for a while. He had been asked to handle this interview, even though he hardly had the time for it. He looked at his watch. It was 8:45 a.m. Another glorious day that would pass him by. He looked at the young man sitting quietly next to the imam, waiting for his court-appointed defense lawyer. His name was Khalil Kazi, and he had apparently confessed to murdering Jamal Chowdhury out of love for his sister. Out of love? It was incomprehensible. But that was Bublansky's unhappy lot in life. People did terrible things, and it was his responsibility to understand why and to bring them to justice. He looked at the imam and the young man, and for some reason he thought of the ocean. Blomqvist woke up in Salander's double bed on Fiskergaten. It had not exactly been his plan, but it was his own fault. He had turned up on her doorstep and been let in with a silent nod. Admittedly, at first, they just worked and shared information, but it had been an eventful day for both of them, and in the end Blomqvist could no longer keep his mind on what they were doing. He wiped the dried blood from her lip and asked about the dragon in Storkirken. It was 1:30 in the morning, and the summer sky was already brightening as they sat on her sofa.
"Was that the reason you had the dragon tattooed on your back?"
"No," Frith said.
Clearly she did not want to talk about it, and he had no wish to press her. He was tired and was getting up to go home when Salander pulled him onto the sofa again and placed a hand on his chest.
"I had it done because it helped me," she said.
"Helped you?
How?" "I thought about the dragon when I was strapped to the bed at St. Stephen's."
"What were you thinking?"
"That it looked helpless, with a spear stuck in its body, but that one day it would rise up, breathe fire and destroy its enemies. That's what kept me going."
Her eyes were dark and apprehensive. She and Blomqvist looked at each other, and they might have been about to kiss. But Salander seemed miles away, and she turned to gaze out over the city and at a train which was rolling into Central Station. She said that she had tracked down Rachel Greitz via an online store in Sollentuna which sold disinfectants. Blomqvist murmured his appreciation, although it worried him. Soon afterwards, the heat having gone out of the moment, his head started to droop, and he asked if he could lie down for a while on her bed. Salander had no objection. She went to bed herself a little while later, and fell asleep. Now, in the morning, Blomqvist heard sounds from the kitchen. He dragged himself out of bed and turned on the coffee machine. He watched Salander retrieve a Hawaiian pizza from the microwave and sit at the kitchen table. He rummaged around in her refrigerator and swore because there was nothing else to eat. Then he remembered that she had just gotten out of prison, and there had been more than enough for her to do on her first day of freedom. He contented himself with coffee and tuned into P1 on the kitchen radio. He caught the end of the Daily News bulletin and listened to the forecast of record temperatures for the Stockholm area. He said good morning to Salander, who muttered something in return. She was wearing jeans and a black T-shirt, no makeup, and her swollen lip and the bruises on her face looked excruciatingly painful. Shortly afterwards they went down to the street together. They went their separate ways at Slusen. He told her to take it easy, and she nodded. He was on his way to Alfred Ögren Securities. She was going to track down Rachel Greitz. While Khalil Kazi was being questioned in the interview room, his defense lawyer Harold Nielsen sat poking nervously at the table with his pen. There were moments when Bublansky could hardly bear to listen. Khalil should have had a bright future. Instead, he had ruined everything. It had been at the beginning of October, almost 2 years before. After Faria had run away from the apartment in Sikla, she managed secretly to keep in touch with Khalil and told him that she intended to sever all links with the family. They arranged to meet at a café on Norra Bantorget so that she could say goodbye to her youngest brother. Khalil swore that he had not said a word to anybody, but the brothers must have tailed him. They dragged their sister into a car and took her back to Sikla. Faria spent the first few days tied up. They put duct tape over her mouth and a piece of cardboard across her chest, saying, "Whore." Bashir and Ahmed beat her. They spat on her and let other men who came to the apartment do the same. Khalil realized that Faria was no longer regarded as a sister, even a human being. Her body was no longer hers, and he was afraid he could guess what was in store for her. She would be taken to some remote place beyond the reach of the police, where her blood would be shed to cleanse the family's honor. Occasionally they talked about how she might be saved through marriage to Kumar, but Khalil did not believe that. She had already been defiled, and how would they get her out of the country while keeping her under control? Khalil was sure that Faria was facing certain death. He too had had his telephone taken away, and was effectively a prisoner, so there was no way he could raise the alarm. In his despair he could only hope for a miracle. A small miracle did occur, or at least a measure of relief. They untied Faria's hands and got rid of the sign, and she was allowed to shower, eat in the kitchen, and move around in the apartment without a veil. Presents were handed out, and it seemed as if Faria were to be given compensation for her suffering, instead of harsher punishment. The brothers gave her a radio, and for Khalil they found a second-hand stairmaster, brought over by an acquaintance in Hudinga. That built up his strength. He'd been missing his running.
his freedom of movement, the power of his stride, and now he trained for hours on end. He began to see light at the end of the tunnel, even though he still expected the worst. Some days later, Bashir and Ahmed came into his room and sat on the bed. Bashir was holding a pistol, but even so, the brothers did not appear angry. Both were wearing freshly ironed shirts in the same shade of blue. They smiled at him.
"We've got good news," Bashir said.
Faria would be allowed to live, or rather she would be allowed to live, as long as someone paid the price. Anything else would bring down the wrath of Allah. Their honour would not be avenged, and the stain would spread and poison them all. Khalil was given a choice. He could either die, together with his sister, or he must murder Jamal, and thereby save the two of them. Khalil did not understand at first. He did not want to understand, he said. He just kept up his stepping on his stairmaster. So they put the choice to him again.
"But why me?" Khalil said. "I could never hurt anybody."
He was utterly distraught. Bashir explained that, of all the brothers, only Khalil was not known to the police. He had a good reputation. Above all, by doing this, Khalil could atone for having failed the family. At some point he must have answered yes, he would kill Jamal. He was desperate, caught in an impossible situation. He loved his sister, and his life was threatened. But there was one detail Bublansky did not understand. Why had Khalil not called the police when he was let out of the apartment to carry out the murder? Khalil claimed he had planned to do exactly that. He was going to reveal everything and seek protection. But then he was bewildered and paralyzed, he said, by the precision with which the operation had been prepared. Others were also involved, Islamists who never let him out of their sight, and who missed no opportunity to tell him what a despicable person Jamal was. Jamal had a fatwa against him. He had been condemned to death by devout people in Bangladesh. He was worse than swine, and Jews and rats that spread the plague. He had besmirched the family's honour and that of his sister. Slowly but surely, Khalil was drawn into the darkness and driven to do the unthinkable. He pushed Jamal in front of the train. He was certainly not alone, but it was he who had run onto the platform and pushed him.
"I killed him," he said.
Faria Kazi was in the visitors' room in H Block of Floodbury. Inspector Sonia Modig and Annika Giannini were sitting facing her. The proceedings were tense and halting as Giannini replayed the poor quality video in which Bashir appeared to confess to having been involved in Jamal Chowdhury's murder. Giannini explained hand movement analyses and told her that Khalil had made a detailed statement confessing that he pushed Jamal under the train.
"He thought it was the only way to save you, Faria, and to save himself. He says he loves you."
Faria did not respond. She knew all of this already, and she wanted to scream, "Loves me? I hate him." She really did hate him, but Khalil was the reason she had kept her mouth shut for so long. However much Khalil may have hurt her, she still felt protective towards him. Mostly for their mother's sake, she thought. Once upon a time Faria had promised her that she would look after Khalil, but now there wasn't any family left to protect, was there? She steeled herself, then looked at the women and said,
"Is that Lisbeth Salander's voice in the film?"
"It is, yes."
"Is she okay?"
"She's okay.
She's been fighting in your corner."
Faria swallowed. She drew herself up and began to talk. The atmosphere in the room was one of solemn anticipation, as always when, after a long silence, a witness or suspect decides to speak. Giannini and Murdig were concentrating so hard that they did not hear the intercoms going off in the corridor, and the rising agitation in the voices of the guards. It was unbearably hot in the visitors' room. Murdig mopped the sweat from her forehead and repeated what Faria had said, twice now, in two versions which were similar, and yet not quite the same. Something still seemed to be missing.
"So you had the sense that your situation was improving. You thought your brothers were relenting, that you might be given some sort of freedom after all."
"I'm not sure what I thought," Faria said. "I was a wreck. But they did apologize. Bashir and Ahmed had never treated me like that before. They said they had gone too far, that they were ashamed, that all they wanted was for me to live a respectable life, and that I had been punished enough. They gave me a radio."
"Did it occur to you at any stage that it might be a trap?"
"I thought that constantly. I'd read about other girls who'd let themselves be lulled into a sense of security and then... and then killed. I realized that there was a real risk, not least because of Bashir's body language, which scared me. I hardly slept. I had a knot in my stomach. But I was also guilty of wishful thinking. You have to understand, it was the only way for me to bear it. I missed Jamal so much, I was going crazy. More than anything, I hoped. I believed Jamal was out there, somewhere, fighting for me. I bided my time and told myself that things were improving. Khalil, meanwhile, kept working out on his stairmaster like an insane person. I heard that step machine thumping away all night long. Swoosh, swoosh. It was driving me mad. I have no idea how he could do it. He just wouldn't stop. And occasionally he'd come out of his room and hug me and say, I'm sorry, 100 times over. I said I would look after him and make sure that Jamal and his friends protected us both. And maybe, I don't know. It's hard to say now, looking back.
"Try to be clear. It's important," Modig said, more sharply than usual. Janini looked at her watch and patted down her hair and said angrily,
"Enough of that. If Arya's being unclear, it's because the situation itself was unclear. Under the circumstances, I think she's being admirably clear." "I'm simply trying to understand," Modig said. "Faria, you must have realized that something was about to happen. You say that Khalil was in a state of high tension, that he was exercising so hard there was nothing left of him. He was in a really bad way. He was a prisoner, too. But I had the impression that he was beginning to feel better, and it was only afterwards that I remembered the look in his eye. And how did he look? Desperate, like a hunted animal. But at the time I didn't see it." "You didn't hear your other brothers leave the apartment on the evening of October 23rd? "I was asleep, or at least trying to sleep. But I do remember that they came back in the middle of the night and were whispering in the kitchen. I couldn't hear what they were saying. The next day they gave me odd looks, and I took that as a good sign. It seemed to me that Jamal was somewhere nearby. I felt his presence. But as the hours passed, this weird, dense atmosphere was building up. Evening came, and then I saw Ahmed, just as I told you."
"You said he was by the window."
"There was something angry, something menacing about the way he stood there, and he was breathing heavily. I felt a weight on my chest. Ahmed said, 'He's dead.' I didn't understand who he was talking about. He tried again. 'Jamal's dead,' he said, more loudly. I think I sank to my knees. I blacked out for a moment. I hadn't really taken it in."
"You were in shock," Janini said. "And yet, an instant later, you found this incredible strength," Modig said.
"I've already explained that."
"She has, you know," Janini said. "I'd like to hear it again."
"Khalil was there all of a sudden,"
Faria said.
"Or maybe he'd been there all along. He cried out that he was the one who had killed Jamal, and that made even less sense. But he went on saying he'd done it for my sake, that they would have murdered me otherwise. He'd had to choose between me and Jamal. And that's when the strength came to me, that fury. I just lost it, and I went for Ahmed."
"Why not Khalil?"
"Because I..."
"Because you..."
"Because I must have understood in spite of it all."
"What? That they'd used Khalil's love for you as a means of pressuring him into this terrible act?
That they'd driven him to it? That they'd destroyed his life along with mine and Jamal's? And that's why I flew into a blind rage. I went crazy. Can't you get that?"
"I can," Murdoch said. "Honestly, I can. But there are other things I find more difficult to understand. For example, the fact that you refused to answer any questions during your police interviews. You said you wanted revenge, but you could have struck back also against Bashir, the biggest criminal of them all. With our help, you could have had him put away for conspiracy to murder."
"But don't you understand?"
Faria's voice broke.
"Don't we understand what?" "My life ended with Jamal's. What would I gain by having Bashir or Khalil locked up as well? Khalil was the only one in the family who..."
"Go on."
"He was the only one I loved.
But he killed the love of your life."
"I hated him. I loved him. I hated him. Is that so hard to understand?"
Janini was just about to interrupt to say that Faria needed a break from the interview when there was a knock at the door. Richard Fager wanted to have a word with Modig. It was immediately clear that something serious had happened.
that whatever it was had shaken the governor's confidence. Modig was irritated that he was being so long-winded. He would not get to the point, as if he intended to find excuses rather than to explain. He said there had been security guards and surveillance and even metal detectors. He said not to forget that Benito had been in a serious condition, having sustained injuries to her skull, a concussion, and a smashed jaw. "She's escaped from the hospital, is that what you're trying to say?" Fargo was not to be put off.
"No one expected she would be able to leave the place."
All visitors had been searched, or at least should have been searched. But then something happened to the hospital's computer system. It crashed, and some of the medical equipment stopped working. The situation became serious. Doctors and nurses were running around all over the place, and just then three men in suits turned up. They told reception that they were there to visit another patient, an engineer from ABB, apparently, who was on the same ward. Then things happened quickly. The men were armed with nunchakus. Farga, that idiot, started to explain that nunchakus were wooden sticks used in martial arts. Modig waved it all away.
"What actually happened, for heaven's sake?" "These men overpowered the security, hustled Benito out of the hospital, and disappeared in a grey van with what turned out to be fake number plates. One of the men has been identified as Esbjörn Falk, a Svavelsjö MC, the criminal motorcycle gang."
"I know what Svavelsjö MC is," Modig said.
"So what's been done so far?" "There's a nationwide alert issued on Benito. We've told the media. Alvar Olsson's under protection."
"And Lisbeth Salander? What about her?"
"Idiot," she muttered,
then said she had to leave right away because the situation required immediate action. On her way out through prison security, she called Bublansky and told him about Benito and about Faria Kazi's interview. He quoted an ancient Jewish saying back to her. "One can see into a man's eyes, but not into his heart."
Chapter 18. June 22nd. Dan Brody was late for work again today. He was agitated and listless, haunted by dark thoughts. But he was better dressed for the weather, in a light blue linen suit, a T-shirt and sneakers. The sun beat down as he walked along Birger Jorsgården, thinking about Leo. All of a sudden he heard a car's screeching halt, and he staggered, just as he had at the Fotografiska Museum. For a moment he struggled for breath. Yet he kept walking and became re-immersed in his thoughts. Those days in December, after their first weekend together, were still the happiest of his life, in spite of moments of pain and resentment. He and Leo had talked and played music without interruption, but they never left the building together, only ever one at a time. For they had devised a plan. They were going to confront Greitz, and she must not suspect anything. December, 1.5 years earlier. Leo cancelled his Christmas lunch at a restaurant with Greitz and invited her over to his place at 1 p.m. on December 23rd instead. In the meantime, the brothers enjoyed playing games with their identities. Out and about in town, they were both Leo, and that amused them enormously. Dan borrowed Leo's suits, shirts and shoes. He had his hair cut like Leo's and practiced being Leo with role-play. Leo kept saying that Dan was the more convincing of the two of them. "You're more Leo than I am." Leo did only short days at the office. One evening he went out with his colleagues to Riccia, but even then he was back early to tell Dan that he'd come this close. He showed Dan with a thumb and forefinger to revealing their secret to Marlin.
"But you didn't say anything."
"Oh, no. She seems to think I'm in love."
"Is she upset?"
"No, not really." Dan knew that Leo had a flirtation going with Marlin Frode, who was getting divorced and would soon be leaving Alfred Ugren. But Leo always claimed it wasn't serious. He thought she had her eye on Blomqvist, the journalist. And anyway, Leo didn't think he loved her either. They were just fooling around, he said, mostly. He and Leo were always swapping ideas and memories and gossip. They made a pact which seemed unbreakable and rehearsed in detail what they would do when Greitz arrived, how Dan would hide himself and Leo would question her, cautiously at first, and then more aggressively. The day before the lunch, December 22nd, a Friday, Marlin was giving a farewell party at a home on Bondegarten. Just like Dan, Leo disliked parties in small spaces. There was too much noise. He could not bring himself to go, he said. He had another idea. He would show Dan his office at Alfred Ugren. The building would probably be deserted, because most of the staff would be at Marlin's, and no one worked late on a Friday evening, especially one so close to Christmas. Dan thought it sounded like a good idea. He was curious about Leo's work. At around 8 p.m. they left the apartment, 10 minutes apart. Leo first, with one bottle of good Burgundy and another of champagne in his briefcase. Dan left 10 minutes later, also dressed in Leo's clothes, but in a paler suit and a darker overcoat. It was cold. It was snowing. They were going to celebrate. They planned to go public with their story the day after their meeting with Greitz, and even though Dan was against it, Leo had promised him a substantial sum of money. There would be no more inequality between them, he said, and no more boring investment banking. He would leave his job and the gloominess of Alfred Ogren so that they could begin playing music together. The evening got off to a wonderful start. They drank and toasted each other, and the air was full of promise. Tomorrow, they said. Tomorrow. But something went wrong. Dan thought it was because of Leo's office. There were Renaissance angels on the ceiling, turn-of-the-century art on the walls, and gilt handles on the chests of drawers. It was so opulent and vulgar that Dan became provocative. He needled his brother. "Looks like you have it made," he said. Leo agreed. "I know. I feel ashamed. I've never liked this room. It was my father's." Dan pushed things a step further. "You were hell-bent on bringing me here, though, weren't you? You wanted to show off and ram all this down my throat." "Oh, no, I'm sorry," Leo said. "I just wanted you to see my life. I know it's unfair." "Unfair!" Dan raised his voice. The word was no longer enough. It was obscene. It was beyond belief. They argued back and forth, Dan accusing Leo, then calming down and apologizing, before going on the offensive again. And then, it was hard to know at what point, Dan had gone too far. The resentment that had been lying beneath the surface, causing tension from the beginning but kept in check by the delirious joy of their meeting, now broke out. Not only did it tear open a wound between them, it seemed to cast the whole situation in a new light. "You've had all of this, yet all you do is complain. Mama doesn't understand me. Papa didn't have a clue. I wasn't allowed to play music. It was so tough. Poor little rich me. I don't want to hear another word. Don't you get that? I was beaten and I went hungry. I had nothing, absolutely nothing, and you—" Dan was shaking all over. He had no idea what had come over him. Perhaps they were both drunk. He accused Leo of being a shit and an insincere bastard, a show-off who flaunted his depressions. He was about to smash a pair of Chinese vases, but instead he walked out, slamming the door behind him. He spent hours wandering the streets, freezing cold and crying. Eventually he ended up back at the Archapman Youth Hostel at Schepsholmen and spent the night there. But at 11 the next morning he went back to Leo's apartment on Floregatan and hugged him, and they both apologized. They turned their attentions to preparing themselves for the meeting with Greitz. Still, something unresolved hung in the air, which would affect what was about to happen. A year and a half later Dan was thinking of that time as he turned into Smålandsgatan, and his face showed it. He passed the Konstnärsbaren restaurant and emerged on Norrmalmstorg. The weather was hot for 10 in the morning. He was not feeling all that well, and was certainly not looking forward to meeting Sweden's most famous investigative journalist. Rachel Greitz and Benito Andersson, who had nothing in common save their sadism and the fact that neither was currently in good physical health, were both looking forward to meeting Lisbeth Salander. Neither knew who the other was, and if they should have happened to meet, they would have regarded each other with contempt. But they were equally single-minded and equally determined to get Salander out of the picture, and they each had their networks. Benita was associated with that particular chapter of Svavelsjö MC, which from time to time received information from Salander's sister, Camilla, and her group of hackers. Greitz could rely on backup from her organization, which had its own technologically savvy resources as well. Above all, Greitz had her willpower and her vigilance, despite the cancer. She had for the time being taken up residence in a hotel on Kungsholmen to keep anyone from following her home. She was well aware that things were going badly. She had foreseen it, in fact, ever since December 23rd, 2 Christmases ago, when everything had fallen apart. At the time she had done what she had done because she saw no choice. It had been a bold gamble on her part, and now she stood ready once more. She would have preferred to start with Salander and von Kantaborg, but the two women were impossible to track down, so she decided to deal first with Daniel Brolin. He was the weak link. She came walking along Hamngarten, past MK department store, dressed in a thin grey coat and skirt and a black cotton turtleneck. Despite the nausea and pain, she felt strong. But the heat was getting to her. What had happened to Sweden? When she was young, there had never been a summer like this one. This was tropical. It was insane. She felt hot and sticky, but she pulled herself together and drew her shoulders back. Further down the street, as she passed two men in blue overalls digging a hole at the edge of the pavement, she caught the smell of drains in the stifling, stagnant air. She thought the men looked overweight and ugly. She walked on to Nordmalmstorg and was about to reach Alfred Ögren's building when she made a deeply troubling discovery. Mikael Blomqvist, the journalist, whom she had already encountered on the stairs at Hilda's place in Skanstol, now on his way into the firm's offices. Greitz took a step into the shadows and called Benjamin. Dan Brody, or Leo Mannheimer, as he called himself nowadays, was sitting in his far too elegant office, and felt his pulse pounding and the walls closing in on him. What was he to do? His junior advisor, as his male secretary liked to style himself, had informed him that Mikael Blomqvist was in reception. Dan had said that he would be ready for him in 20 minutes. Even as he said it, he knew it sounded impolite. But, as so often in the past, he needed time to think. Who knows? Maybe Blomqvist would help him get even with Greitz, whatever the cost might be. December, 1.5 years earlier. It was snowing that day at Floregatan as they waited for Rachel Greitz. Dan apologized, again and again.
"It's okay," Leo said. "I had a visitor at the office yesterday after you left."
"Who was that?"
"Marlin. We finished the champagne. It wasn't a great success. I wasn't at my best. I was in the middle of writing something. Would you like to see?"
Dan nodded. Leo got up from the piano and left the room. He came back a minute later with a sheet of paper inside a plastic folder. He looked solemn and burdened by guilt. With a slow, deliberate gesture, he handed over the document, which was sand-coloured and lightly textured with a watermark at the top.
"I think it needs to be witnessed," he said.
The handwriting was neat and full of flourishes. The document stated that Leo was hereby giving half of all his assets to Dan.
"Jesus," Dan said.
"I'm seeing my lawyer after Christmas," Leo said. "Given the circumstances, it should all go smoothly. I don't even see it as a gift. You're getting what should have been yours a long time ago."
Dan was silent. He knew he should be throwing his arms around his brother and saying, "It's too much, it's crazy, you're being far too generous." But what was written on the document did not make him feel any better, or the situation any clearer, and initially he could not understand why. He felt oversensitive and ungrateful. Then he decided there was something passive-aggressive about the gift. The money was being given to him from a position of overwhelming advantage, and however grand the gesture, it was also diminishing. So he said in a resolute voice, "I can't accept it." He saw despair in Leo's eyes.
"But why not? It doesn't work like that. You can't fix it that easily." "I didn't think I needed to fix anything. I just wanted to do the right thing. I'm not interested in the damn money anyway." "Not interested?"
Dan went crazy, even though some part of him must have realized how absurd it was. He had been handed tens of millions of kronor, which would fundamentally change his life, yet he felt offended and angry. It could have been because of their argument the day before, or because he had been drinking and had hardly slept. It could have been because of any number of things.
"You just don't get it," he yelled. "You can't say that to someone who's always lived a marginal existence. It's too late, Leo, too late." "No, it's not. We can begin again. It's just too late."
"Stop," Leo shouted back. "You're being unfair. I feel like I'm being bought. Do you understand that? Bought!"
He was going too far, and he knew it, and it hurt when Leo did not come back at him with the same fury. Instead, Leo simply answered sadly,
"I know." "What do you know? Those people destroyed almost everything. I hate them for it, but still we found each other. That's what's important, isn't it?"
There was such despair in his voice that Dan muttered, "I'm grateful, of course, but..." He got no further. He regretted the "but" and was about to say something else, like, "Sorry, I'm an idiot." He remembered it so well afterwards. They were on the verge of a reconciliation, and would no doubt have found each other again, given time. Instead they heard sounds in the hallway, footsteps, and then silence. It was a minute before midday. Racco Grout was not due for an hour, and Leo had not even set the table.
"Hide," he whispered.
Leo put away the document, and Dan went into one of the bedrooms and closed the door. Leo had always been a source of worry, and not only because of the business with Carl Sager. He had been unpredictable of late. She thought it might have something to do with Madeline Bard. Losing Madeline had made him suspicious. Sir Grouch wondered what was up when he cancelled their Christmas lunch and invited her instead to his apartment. She knew everything about Leo. She knew, for example, that like many bachelors, he did not like to cook or invite anyone over, especially not anyone with whom he did not feel entirely comfortable. Grouch had therefore decided to show up early, with the excuse that she wanted to help in the kitchen. But in fact, what she wanted to know was whether something had happened, or if he had discovered anything about his adoption. As she stepped out of the lift into the hallway with its painted blue ceiling, she heard agitated voices coming from inside the apartment, and they were strangely alike. Suddenly the voices stopped, and she knew that whoever they belonged to was aware of her presence. Leo's hearing was quite exceptional. She was shaken to realize that something really was amiss. She texted Benjamin.
"At Leo's at Florgarten. Need your help," she added. "Bring my doctor's bag with everything in it."
Then she drew herself up and knocked, ready with her warmest Christmas smile. But she didn't need it. Leo was already beaming in the doorway, and as always, he kissed her on both cheeks and helped her off with her coat, as he had been brought up to do. He was far too tactful to point out that she was an hour early.
"You're looking as elegant as ever, Rackle. What a Christmas this is going to be," he said.
He's playing his part well, she thought. She only detected traces of tension in his face after studying him very carefully. He might have been able to deceive her had things been different. But she had keen eyes. He had been careless, which he no doubt knew himself. A moment before there had been voices, and now he was on his own. And there was a guitar lying on the sofa.
"How's Vivica?" she said.
"I don't think she's got much longer."
"Poor thing.
It's just awful."
"Bullshit," she thought. "I bet you're glad the bitch is finally on her way out." "When both parents are gone, there's only you left," she said, touching his arm.
She wanted to reassure him, to show her sympathy, and at the same time hide her suspicion. But that was a miscalculation. Leo shuddered, evidently affected by the physical contact, and there was a flash of anger in his eyes. For a moment she felt frightened and looked again at the guitar. She decided to let things rest for a while. She wanted to give Benjamin time to pack her doctor's bag and make his way over, so she kept the conversation going for another 10 minutes, but then she could stand it no longer.
"Who's here?"
"Who do you think?" Leo said. She had no idea, she told him. But that was a lie. Things were beginning to fall into place, and she could see how tense Leo now was, how he was looking at her as he never had before. She realized she would have to strike hard and mercilessly before Daniel Brolin appeared from wherever he was hiding.
Chapter 19 June 22nd
Rachel Greitz was not at home on Karlbergsvägen, and Salander decided to bide her time. She took the Tunnelbana back to Slussen and then walked along Utegarten. She had heard from Giannini that Benito had been sprung from Örebro Hospital, and so she was on her guard. She was always on her guard. Life in prison had made her, if anything, more careful, but even so she might be underestimating the danger she was in. There were more alliances after her than she realized. Sinister forces from the past were mustering their followers, exchanging information, and perhaps agreeing to work together. It was a scalding June day, and life in the city seemed to have slowed down. People were mooching about, window shopping, or sitting out on the terraces of cafes and restaurants. Salander went on up towards Fiskargatan. There was a buzzing in her pocket, an encrypted text from Blomqvist.
"Leo is Daniel. I'm as good as certain."
She wrote,
"Is he talking?"
He answered,
"Don't know yet. We'll get back to you."
She considered making her way to Alfred Ogren's offices on Norrmalmstorg to see how Blomqvist was getting on, but decided against it. She wanted first to get hold of Rachel Greitz, or to see if she could trace her to another address. Her watchfulness remained high as she walked up Fiskergatan towards her apartment building, and she wondered if it really was such a good idea to go home. There was no official record of her living there. The apartment was registered to Irene Nesser, an identity she occasionally assumed. She had put up a number of smoke screens, but the net was closing in. People were beginning to recognize her. She was something of a celebrity these days, and she hated that. Also, two people, Kelly fucking Blomqvist and the NSA agent Ed the Ned, had tracked her down here before, and word does tend to get out. She should sell the damn place. It was too big for her anyway. She should move far away, maybe even take off right now. But it was too late. She realized it the moment she saw a grey van facing in her direction further up the street. There was nothing outwardly remarkable about it. It was an old model, parked perfectly normally by the curb. Still, it made her suspicious. And now it was rolling towards her. She turned back down the hill, but she had gone only a few paces when a bearded man suddenly appeared from a doorway and put a wet rag over her face. She felt sick, but above all she felt stupid and careless. And now she was just about to pass out. The street and the buildings danced around her. She had no strength to resist. She managed only to pull out her mobile and whisper the code word, Harpy, before she felt herself falling, and was lifted in through the back doors of the van. Her vision was blurred, but she detected a sweet perfume, which was only too familiar. December, 1.5 years earlier. Dan heard the voices in the drawing room and realized that nothing was going as planned. Greitz seemed to have seen straight through them, and the element of surprise that they had hoped for was no longer an option. He decided to go in and confront her. But Dan had underestimated the effect that Greitz would have on him. Her physical presence cast him right back to his childhood self. He remembered her standing on the upper floor of the farm all those years ago, observing him coldly as he played his guitar. She must have been comparing him to Leo even then, studying their similarities, and at this realization he lost his composure. "You know who I am, I guess," he said, wild with rage. He took a step forward, but he could not help still feeling small. Greitz stood her ground, astonishingly composed. "Of course I do," she said. "How are you?" "We want to know exactly what happened to us," Dan shouted at her, and only then did she back away. But she remained calm as she adjusted her collar and looked at her watch. Even though she was nervous, the twitch around her mouth made that evident. She had a stature and an icy cool about her, like a schoolmistress, and this made Dan feel that it was he rather than she who was about to be castigated.
"You need to calm down," she said.
"No way," Dan said. "You've got a lot of explaining to do."
"And I will explain. I will. But first I need to know if you've gone to the press."
When there was no response, Greitz went on,
"I do understand that you're upset, but it would be dangerous for the story to get out now, before you know the full picture. It's not what you imagine."
"We haven't gone public." "Yet," Dan said, and wondered straight away if that was a mistake, the more so when he saw a hint of satisfaction in Greitz's face. He looked at Leo. Leo was standing there, silent, feet planted, giving him no clue as to how he should act. How could he stop Greitz taking the initiative?
"I'm an old woman now," she said, "and I'm having terrible stomach pains. Forgive me for being so frank. Is it okay if I sit down? Then I'll tell you whatever you want to know."
"Go ahead," Leo said eventually. "Make yourself comfortable. We want answers to all our questions." Greitz began hesitantly, hoping that Benjamin would show up before she had to give away anything that really mattered, or was forced to tell any ill-considered lies. Leo and Daniel sat opposite her, each in his own armchair, and glared at her, wanting answers. Despite the tension and the air of crisis, she was amazed at how astoundingly alike the brothers were, more than was common in identical twins of their age. The fact that they had the same haircut and wore the same kind of clothes made the similarity yet more striking.
"Here's how it was," she said. We found ourselves in an extremely difficult situation. We had reports from several children's homes and hospitals about identical twins whose parents were not able to take care of them.
"Who's we?" Daniel broke in. And even though his voice was angry and full of hate, she welcomed any interruption. She said, on a sudden inspiration, that she had been given something, she had it in her coat, which would perhaps help them to understand the situation. Should she fetch it? She wondered if she was being even remotely credible. But they let her go, and that filled her with contempt. Daniel and Leo were weak and pathetic, weren't they? When she got to the hall, she coughed, to cover the sound of her unlocking the front door. She then made a pretense of looking for something in her coat pocket, and exclaimed, "Hopeless." She came back to the sofa, shaking her head, and went on talking in vague terms. This exasperated Leo, and when she casually mentioned Carl Seger, his blood rose, and he looked almost unhinged. He called her a monster and demanded that she explain what had happened to Carl. That really frightened her, because she remembered the fits of rage which both boys had manifested when they were young. In the end, Leo's outburst turned out to be a good thing, because at that moment Benjamin appeared. The shouting must have stiffened his resolve, because he strode in without knocking and grabbed hold of Leo from behind. Meanwhile, Greitz bent to dig around in the doctor's bag, which Benjamin had dropped at her feet. Leo cried out for help, and Daniel made a rush for Benjamin. She knew she needed to be resolute. Quickly, quickly, she rummaged through the medication in the bag. Stesolid, opiates, morphine, the lot, and then a chill ran through her. Pancuronium bromide, a synthetic curare to mimic the extract used on poison arrows. That would be too brutal. But wait, there was also physostigmine, an antidote which could either wholly or partly neutralize its effect. She had an idea, inspired by an accusation Daniel had spat out during their conversation, which suggested that he harbored a deep bitterness. It was a bold and wild idea. She pulled on her latex gloves. Benjamin was immovable as ever and had a firm hold on Leo, who was screaming as Daniel tried to tear him free. She prepared a syringe. It took an extra moment to get the dose right. She realized she would have to inject straight into the muscle. There was no time to find a vein, but perhaps there was an advantage in that. At least that's what she told herself as she jabbed the needle through Leo's sweater. He looked at her in shock while Daniel bawled, "What are you doing? What the fuck are you doing?" She grimaced. The neighbors below must be wondering about the racket, and if they came up, Leo might already be convulsing. He would begin to suffocate as soon as his respiratory muscles ceased to function. The situation was critical, and she was in danger. She had crossed yet another line, and more than ever she needed to keep her wits about her. In her most authoritative doctor's voice, she said, "Calm down now, both of you. I've only given him a sedative, nothing more. Breathe, Leo, breathe. Good. You'll soon feel better. We've got to talk like sensible people. You've got to stop yelling like that. This is John. He works with me. He's medically trained. I'm quite sure we can work this out, and it's high time I told you the rest of this sad story. I'm so glad you found each other at last."
"You're lying," Daniel hissed.
Things were getting out of hand. There was far too much noise, and by now she was terrified that the neighbors would be on their way. She kept talking, trying to defuse the situation, all the while counting down the seconds to the inevitable consequence of her injection. The poison penetrating Leo's blood and acting on the nicotinic acetylcholine receptors to inhibit his muscles. The building was still quiet. No one had called the police. Now Leo was beginning to stiffen, as she knew he would, and spasmodic movements sent him crashing to the red Persian rug. This was an extreme step even for her, but Greitz savored the dizzying feeling of power. She could save his life at any moment. Or she could let him die. The circumstances would dictate. Her mind needed to be clear, sharp and convincing, so that she could work on Daniel's evident bitterness and sense of inferiority. She would get him to play the role of his life. As Leo fell to the ground, Dan realized that something was terribly wrong. His brother had collapsed as if his body had simply stopped functioning. Leo was grabbing at his throat and seemed paralyzed. Dan forgot everything else and crouched next to his brother, screaming and shaking him. When Greitz began to speak, he was barely listening. He was wholly concentrated on trying to restore life to Leo, and anyway, she was saying something far too outlandish for him to take in.
Daniel, she said, we can make this work. We'll see to it that you're better off than you could ever have imagined. From now on, you'll have an incredible life with unlimited resources.
It was nonsense, of course, empty words, and all the while Leo was getting worse. He was whimpering and convulsing. His face was ash grey, and his lips blue, and he was fighting for breath. He seemed to be suffocating. His eyes were watery and panic-stricken. The bluish tinge spread from his lips out to his cheeks, and Dan prepared to give him artificial respiration. But Grice stopped him and was saying something, and he could not help but listen. By now he was willing to grasp at straws. Grice's tone seemed different now, not as impassioned as before, more like a soothing doctor. She took Leo's pulse and smiled reassuringly at Dan.
"There's nothing to worry about," she said. "He's just suffering some cramps. He'll be fine soon. The dose I gave him was powerful but not dangerous. See for yourself."
She handed Dan the syringe, and he looked at it in his hand, at a loss as to what it could prove or tell him.
"Why are you giving me this?"
He looked at her as she stood next to the big man who was still wearing his jacket and winter boots. A terrifying thought struck him.
"You want my fingerprints on this, don't you?" He dropped the syringe. "Calm down, Daniel. Listen to me."
"Why the hell should I listen to you?" He pulled out his mobile. He had to call an ambulance, but a threatening, lurching movement from the man stopped him. His panic intensified. Were they trying to kill Leo? Was that even imaginable? He was terror-stricken, and next to him Leo gasped and looked as if he was about to die. Dan yelled straight into Leo's hypersensitive ear. "Fight! You can do it!" Leo's forehead furrowed. He gritted his teeth. A patch of colour returned to his face, but it soon drained away. And again he seemed to be fighting for air. Dan turned to Grice.
"Save him, for God's sake! You're a doctor! You're not trying to kill him, are you?" "What are you talking about? Of course not. He'll soon be back on his feet, you'll see. Move away so I can assist him," she said.
When he saw how smoothly and professionally she handled the contents of her bag, he felt he had no alternative but to trust her. It was as good a measure as any of the extent of his desperation. He held his twin brother's hand, hoping that the person who had injected him with poison would also be the one to save him. That was precisely what Grice was thinking, how critical it was for her to behave like a doctor and inspire confidence. She resisted the urge to block Leo's airways and make short work of the whole process, and instead prepared a syringe with physostigmine before pushing up the sleeve of Leo's sweater to inject the substance into a vein. He improved rapidly, although he was still dazed. She felt, and this is what mattered most, that she had regained some of Daniel's trust.
"Will he be okay?" he asked.
"He'll be fine," she said, and kept on talking. She was improvising, but she could draw on the emergency plan which had been in place for some time. Years ago, Eva Ogren had gotten hold of Leo's login details at the firm, and in Leo's name, or rather using various names, dummy companies, and other fronts, had made a series of illegal transactions in the share and derivatives markets. Details of these had been collected in a file which could not only spell Leo's social and professional ruin, but also put him in prison. Eva had already used the information to get his hands on Madeleine Bard, and Grice did not approve. Her private opinion was that Eva was stupid, but in the end she had acquiesced. After all, she needed the information he had gathered in order to put pressure on Leo if ever he found out anything and tried to expose her.
"Listen to me, Daniel," she said. "I have to tell you something. It may be the most important thing you'll have heard in your whole life."
There was such a pleading look on his face that she was filled with confidence. She spoke in a voice that was both soothing and businesslike, like a doctor conveying a diagnosis.
"Leo's a bad apple, Daniel. It hurts me to say it, but that's how it is. He's been involved in insider dealing and illegal transactions. He's going to end up in prison."
"What? What are you saying?" She could tell that he wasn't taking it in. He just kept stroking his brother's hair, telling him that everything was going to be all right. What bullshit. That aggravated Grice, and she took on a sharper tone.
"Listen," I said, "Leo's not what you think. We have proof, and he's going to end up in prison. He's a crook and a swindler."
Daniel looked at her in confusion.
"Why the hell would he do that? He isn't even interested in money." "That's what you think." "Is it?
Before you arrived, he tried to give me half of everything he owns. Just like that.
He gestured with his hand, and she bit her lip. It was not what she wanted to hear.
Why should you make do with only half? I don't want anything at all. I want...
He fell silent, as if he had understood. Certainly he sensed something. Seeing the